I'm going to ask everybody to help me welcome our next panelist. So this is the Females First panel. This panel features females within our legal community who have been able to overcome obstacles and become the first in their positions. On this panel, we have Judge Sean Hastings from the U.S. Bankruptcy Court. If you can just give a wave. Thank you. And then we have Kylie Overson. She's an attorney at Schneider Law Firm. And Ms. Megan Compton, the Chief Legal Counselor at All True Systems. And moderating this panel today is Professor Margaret Jackson. So I'll give it to her. Thank you.
Thank you much, Stephanie. You can see more fully extensive biographies of each of the panelists in your programs, but I just wanted to touch upon highlights. As was stated by Stephanie, Megan Compton is Chief Legal Counsel at All True Health Systems, which is the largest private employer in Grand Forks. Before that, she worked in private practice, and she earned her JD here at UND School of Law in 2010. Judge Sean Hastings also earned her law degree at UND School of Law in 1993, which is around the time that my degree, so we're in the same neighborhood. She did some private practice, and then for about 14 years, she served as an assistant U.S. attorney for the District of North Dakota. In 2011, she became the first woman appointed to the position of U.S. Bankruptcy Court Judge for North Dakota, and she serves as chief judge for that court. And then over there in the end, Kylie Overson currently works as an attorney at the Schneider Law Firm in Fargo, but before she even graduated from law school, she served as chair of the North Dakota Democratic NPL Party, one of only two women to ever hold that position. She earned her JD from the UND School of Law in 2016. I teach anti-discrimination law, and my scholarship focuses on employment discrimination, housing discrimination, and how law can promote inclusion in communities. So I've been thinking about issues of diversity, integration, and the ways in which the law responds to and shapes attitudes about difference. So I'll be posing some questions and asking our panel to weigh in on issues as they wish, in no particular order. And also, we'll be taking questions, written questions from the audience. We have Olivia and Victoria, she'll be here, who have index cards. And so if you're interested in posing a question or getting into an area that we're not heading down the road toward, signal to Olivia or Victoria and write your question, and I'll ask those questions as well. So the topic of this panel is female firsts. Helen Hamilton was the first woman to graduate from the University of North Dakota School of Law. And we have some firsts right here on the panel. I don't have it noted anywhere, but I'd go out on a limb and guess that Megan was the first woman ever to serve as chief legal counsel for the largest private employer in Grand Forks. But along with recognizing these achievements that we might say bend toward gender equity, we know that there's still a dearth of women at the upper echelons of our profession. And although we've seen nearly equal numbers of male and female law graduates the past three decades, the gap between women and men in law firms, in legal academia, and the judiciary remains wide. And particularly striking is the continuing lack of gender diversity in the legal profession's most influential and honored positions, with women making up only a fifth of the partners in law firms. And even when they make partner, data shows that they're paid nearly half the compensation of their male counterparts. Likewise, women continue to be underrepresented as state and federal judges, as appellate practitioners, and in complex litigation. No women served as Article III judges during the first 150 years of the American Republic. It was not until Franklin Delano Roosevelt named Florence Allen to the U.S. Court of Appeals in 1934 that women were even included within the ranks of the federal judiciary. So my question for the panel, which you can address in any order, is what has it been like to be the first or one of the first women to serve in your position?
I'll jump in. I wasn't the first in any particular role, but often only the second or the youngest to ever serve in a role. Prior to becoming chair of the Democratic Party in North Dakota, I served in the state legislature in this district that we're in right now, District 42. And so I was elected when I was 23 years old. And, you know, that experience of being a young woman was difficult at times, but it was often for me, it was the age factor that I noticed would lead to me being treated differently than more than the gender factor. But being chair of the party as a woman at the time was similarly the youngest chair of either party in the country. So it's not traditionally a role that younger people hold. There weren't very many female chairs. And in our state, the last female chair was in the 90s, maybe 20 years prior to when I held the position. And I think we just, you know, being the first or one of few in a position, you recognize the systems and processes that are put in place in a certain position that don't necessarily lend well to women staying in leadership positions. We're having that conversation right now with our party transition. It's not being a chair of a party here isn't a full-time paid position. And so I was doing that while in law school or studying for the bar now, you know, as a practicing attorney. And so finding ways to make the position more friendly to young or working parents is a challenge. I was just having the conversation yesterday with Justice McEvers about, even if you are the first or the second, how do you continue to pave the way so that there's someone else who can step into that role? If not me, who's going to be the next woman who serves as a legislator or as chair of the party? I guess I am the first female attorney in my law firm. It's a small family-based firm and they never hired any female attorneys before I stepped in. And so, you know, when I think I asked about family leave or maternity leave policies, it was, well, we've never had to have that conversation before. And so, you know, being the first in those positions, like I said, it illuminates the systems or processes that are in place within institutions or organizations that never had to think about how they'd have to adjust to having women in those roles. And so it's a learning process, I think, being in those roles, being a first or a second.
Oh, the irony of your comments. So you work for the Schneider Law Firm, and I was hired by John Schneider as among the first female assistant U.S. attorneys in Fargo, North Dakota, for the state, actually. There was one other woman who was promoted from a paralegal position to an attorney position, but Jan Morley and I were the second and third women hired, and John Schneider was determined to add diversity to the office. It was one of his primary goals, which he announced. And so when I applied, it was clear that he was looking for qualified women, and he hired Jan Morley, who's Native American and woman, of course, and me. And I happened to be the first woman to ever go on maternity leave at the U.S. Attorney's Office, where John Schneider had to make up the policies. So it's really funny to hear the same sort of circumstances. He was particularly gracious, but I will say that because I was among the first AUSAs, it was something that they were just completely unused to. He aggressively moved our careers along. He put us in court. He raised our salary. We moved faster through the ranks as AUSAs than any other AUSAs for us. He was determined to make sure that we were treated equally based on our abilities and based on our roles, and so gave us opportunities, insisted that we do the work of all the other AUSAs, and then appropriately rewarded our hard work. So it was on his shoulders that I became the first female supervisor of lawyers in the U.S. Attorney's Office. And in part because of the encouragement of the other men who I worked with who had daughters who wanted to make sure that we were treated fairly. And so it was because of their encouragement and because of their references that I think it was among the reasons why I was appointed. Karen Klein, who was mentioned earlier, Magistrate Judge Klein, was the person who actually suggested that I apply to the bankruptcy judge position and encouraged me to apply. And without her nudge, I probably would not have even considered it.
And once I got to the interview panel, I've learned, you know, 7 years later that in the first interview, I recall there being one woman and later had an opportunity to visit with her about that interview process. And she said, if it were up to me, there would only been two finalists and they would have both been women, but I didn't get my way. But she, I know, in that room, encouraged the men to consider the fact that there had never been a bankruptcy judge appointed who is a woman and to say, look, you have two highly qualified women. Why don't you just submit their names? That didn't happen, but nevertheless, I was fortunate enough to get appointed. But what I'm saying is that women and men who had an interest in making sure that the workforce is diverse have been largely responsible for this opportunity that was given to me. Yes, I worked hard, and I appreciated and followed through with their mentorship, and I was extremely enthusiastic about the law, and I still really am. But they had gender equality in mind, and it was because of them that these firsts were, that I'm blessed to be one of them.
So, my experience is a bit different. I have two parents that were both in banking, and similar to the law, banking is a industry that is predominantly led by men. My mom has been the chief operating officer at a relatively large banking system in several states. And so growing up, I didn't know any better. I didn't know that in that industry or other industries that it feels and looks different. So when I went to law school, came out of law school, went into private practice, I sort of had this expectation that this was the norm. My dad was very supportive of her growing up and played, if not equal, more of a parenting role than she did, although she might debate me on that a bit. So I didn't know any different. So when I went into private practice, I actually had a baby. Some of you know this because I had mentioned it one other time, a week after the bar exam, and then went to work in private practice. And it didn't feel real family friendly. And then I became pregnant and had my second baby. And when we went to have a conversation about maternity leave, I had 2 weeks of vacation, and then I came back to work. It didn't feel real well, or it didn't feel real good. And so it wasn't long after that that I left, not for that reason, but because I was interested particularly in health law. But that is an experience that has certainly shaped sort of my feelings about how women are treated or how they may feel as they navigate, specifically in those early years of their career. Like Kylie, I'm also probably more impacted by age than I am by gender. So now in healthcare is predominantly, there's more women than there is men in healthcare. However, there's less females leading in healthcare positions. So there was not, a female in a chief legal officer position. Actually, there was no one in a legal position at Altru. And I had approached the CEO at the time because we did quite a bit of work with them, and said, you need one internally, and I would like to do that. He gave me the opportunity over several years of working there and recognizing that he would support my career as I transitioned. So today, it's not an issue. In fact, of the 8 executives on our team, 5 of them are female, which is pretty incredible when you think about it. In fact, before I came, I was trying to do some research to better understand, okay, how common is this? How many other organizations our size or larger have that complement? And I couldn't find. It's hard to really find out what that looks like. But I would guess that it's not common. And I would also guess that there's probably not that many women on an executive team in the tri-state area of systems that are our size. So my experience there has been more about, or maybe some of the feelings that I have are more related to my age than it is about my gender. I'm 20 years younger than the next executive on our executive team, and some of those feelings are probably mine and not theirs, and over a period of time have gotten comfortable with the idea that I can use my inexperience to my benefit. You know, when you think about, no matter what industry it is, how we change, it's disruption to our industries. And disruption comes with a change in understanding or a change in mindset. And that often comes from people who either lack the experience or see those experiences very different from how those that have been there before them. And so I feel like it's an opportunity to use that and not apologize for being that much younger than others, but to take advantage of that period of time in your life where maybe you lack the experiences, but you have the opportunity to really question and ask challenging ways of how we do things today and how we might shape the future.
Wow, so much there. It's interesting that the comments of the panel already are, excuse me, are well supported by research on these issues. It isn't just you. The legal system has been called a gendered institution, which is a term borrowed from political science literature, describing fields, careers, or industries that are predominated by one gender. And as observed by Professor Laura Cooper during a meeting of the Eighth Circuit Gender Fairness Task Force, scholars of organizational theory recognize that when an organization is historically developed and currently dominated by persons of one gender, the organization becomes gendered. It becomes structured and operates in such a way as to be responsive to the needs of persons of the majority gender and fails to be responsive or even recognize the needs of persons of the other gender. And she puts it this way: imagine how welcome a man would feel litigating in a federal court system that had never, in its more than 200-year history, had more than a few men serve on its Supreme Court, or more than one man ever serve on the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals. And she concludes by saying, the courts are a gendered institution, and that gender is male. So you've touched on, each panelist has touched on some of these a response already, and many of these go towards a lack of a maternity leave policy. But in what ways, maybe additionally, have you experienced the legal system as a gendered institution during your career? And how, if at all, do you feel it changing?
I could go for it.
Yeah, I can. I can definitely take this one. You've highlighted the fact that there's never been a woman Article 3 judge in North Dakota, and there's never been a woman U.S. attorney in North Dakota. And you just now learned that I was the second/third AUSA ever hired in the District of North Dakota. That's super sad. So here's how it changed because Jen and I started at the U.S. Attorney's Office. First of all, with regard to the maternity leave, there is now a policy. Second of all, the flexibility that is allowed in the workplace, the law in general and law firms in general are pretty traditional, 8 to 5 or 8 to 7. But you're there in the business hours and you're always in suits. And there was an expectation when I first started that if you were going to appear before one of the federal judges, the women had to wear skirts. And I remember being called out one time or two for the skirt thing, and one time or two because I hadn't worn a belt. And so the whole, how do you address the diversity of gender thing was super interesting. One of the things that the office began to allow when I started was some flexibility in working from home. So nobody had ever asked to work from home before. And I remember having to write some really complex appellate briefs or other, employment law briefs or whatever. And so I asked, and again, I began with John Schneider, who is all about accommodation. And so he said, yeah, sure, go ahead and work from home. There were times when that was more accepted or less accepted, and it all depended on who was in charge. But in general, there was more flexibility there. It's still not the type of job that allows for a lot of flexibility in coming in late and leaving early. But I had assumed a pretty large caseload, and it was apparent that I was devoting the time and people knew that I was not taking advantage of the time. And so when there was a need to leave early because I wanted to go see a play that my kid was in or whatever, or come in late, there was more flexibility. Before, it was the men went to coffee at a certain hour. And eventually Jan and I were involved in that, but not initially. And so there was just this certain practice of how things go. When I moved to the bankruptcy court, the clerk, who is a woman, had instituted some policies that I learned later are very unlike other courts in the country. And we recently consolidated with some of our administrative services with the District of South Dakota, who has a very traditional clerk's office. And one of the things that's happening is there's change in flexibility. So there are flex hours now at the bankruptcy court, and there always will be flex hours at the bankruptcy court. And there will be telework allowed once every pay period for each individual person. And we use disaster preparedness as our way to ensure that this happens, but it also allows flexibility. Part-time work is more acceptable, and it's considered. Promotion of women within the court system at the clerk level is a little bit easier because it is more, the majority of the clerk staff are in fact women. And so there's cross training and mentorship programs already in place, at least in the courtroom, in the courts where I work. And so there is some progress that is changing. What I see lagging a little bit behind was progress in the private practice. So when I started at the law firm, there was an expectation of, you know, lots and lots and lots of hours. And it was a large firm in Minneapolis. And the women, as soon as they began to have families, were deciding to opt for other careers. And I actually asked for an opportunity to go part-time. And much like the panelists before us, I had the same response. First of all, the faces of the partners who I asked, they drooped. And it was apparent that I would receive 80% pay for what would be 100% work. All I wanted to do was cut back to 40 hours a week with my first child. And they said, you know, it'll affect your partnership track. And it genuinely affected the partners before me. And so it was a risk that I ended up declining. And then I was lucky enough to be hired as an assistant U.S. attorney relatively quickly. But I know that I didn't have a way to balance that career choice at the time. That philosophy is changing because of you, because of the newer generation. And the most important thing is it's changing for the men as well. My husband is a parent. Without his assistant, there's no way I could have survived private practice, and frankly, no way I could have kept the job that I had as an AUSA, and there's absolutely no way I would be a federal judge, because he picked up and got the girls when they were sick, because his job allowed more flexibility for coming in late and leaving early. And so because of his assistance as the traditional, more flexible spouse, it allowed my career field to progress. What's changing now is that men, like my husband, want to be there too. There are more working families. And so it's the best interest of everyone if everyone has policies that will ensure flexibility, maybe at certain times of your life, but more importantly, as parents of children or as people who have life outside the office. So just because you don't have children wouldn't mean that you would also enjoy more flexibility. Maybe you're not a morning person. So the law clerk who works with me right now has told me when she began, I'm not really a morning person. I said, well, then come in at 9, stay till 6, or work on a weekend. And that's the way it works. So you have an opportunity now with your choices in your law firms. We saw a partner of a law firm who said she works with and allows and will always allow part-time work. And it's encouraged in the bio program from the last panel. These are your choices. These are your personal choices, because you will be there to make the decision. And these two women have just given you the example. It's on their shoulders that you will ride, and it'll be your responsibility to make sure that those policies are carried forward.
I'm just going to add to that point. thank you for the segue about choices. So to that point, I would say that I, and along with several other women, have had the experience of being one of a team, but maybe the only female or one or two of a team of primarily men. So how you navigate that system and how you work through that is maybe different than when you have other female team members or others that are alongside that journey with you. So I think we're at an interesting point in time where females who have predominantly been the one or maybe two of a bigger team are trying to figure out how to navigate with other females just like them at the table. And so how you support each other, how you allow each other to lead and succeed alongside one another is an interest. I think we're at an interesting point in time where that's starting to happen in ways that it hadn't happened before. And I think your point about choices is really important. So some may make choices to work part-time, and we should accept that with no judgment. I have made a choice to take a position that does not allow me very much flexibility, but I also have a spouse that is incredibly supportive of that, who also has faced some societal norms that he doesn't fall into what might be normal. And so as we co-parent through this, but he is the primary parent of our three young children, the two of us are navigating how that might look going forward. So as I think about where we head in the future, it is about choice. You may choose to have a very demanding job, and that's great. You may choose to work part-time for part of your career while you're raising children. That's also great. Having the choice is really important, and then being supported by both men and women in the choices that you make in a non-judgmental way is critical.
I don't even remember what the question was, but I have so many thoughts floating around based on what Judge Hastings and Megan have said. And first noting that John Schneider, who she's talking about, is one of the founders of the firm that I work for, and his nephew, Mac, who is my boss, much in the same way that John encouraged you, was also the reason that I got into politics and the reason that I ran for the legislature, the reason that I ran for party chair. And so those mentors, apparently a lot of them are Schneiders, it's really important to be willing to accept those calls to step up and take advantage of that opportunity when somebody's willing to provide that mentorship. But when I'm thinking about women in these institutions, I think more about my work in government and politics than I do in my legal profession. But I think about, you know, being in the state legislature as a young woman and the policies we talked about, whether it was reproductive health care or child care or I wrote down, we had the repeal of the blue laws, and some of you might remember this conversation. So those are the laws in North Dakota that prohibit businesses from being open and selling retail prior to noon on Sundays. And when this conversation was occurring in 2017 during the session, one of the male legislators said something along the lines of, well, then my wife's not going to be at home to make me breakfast in bed if she can go shopping on Sunday morning. Or somebody else said something about, my wife already spends enough money the way it is. Why does she need another half day to go shopping? And so you just see these very gendered perceptions of what life looks like when your institutions are dominated by men. And I mean, that was prevalent in the legislature and still is. We're right about, I think, 19 or 20% of our legislators are female. We're one of the lower states across the country. We've made very little progress. We've elected more women, but when we elect those other women lose their seats. And so we've remained right about that 20% mark high for a decade, maybe two. And if we, I mean, there's no end in sight to getting gender equality in our governing institutions right now. We've never had a female governor. We've had female attorney general and tax commissioner, justices, you know, other statewide elected officials. But there's definitely still significant barriers to women being in elected positions in the state. And so that's, you know, where my frame of mind is most often, is how we get women elected. And it's, you know, running for office isn't something that's particularly easy to do if you are a working professional or if you're a working parent. I'm seeing a lot of faces of people who I know have run for office. And I, you know, I ran last year for a statewide position, and I don't have any children right now. And he would probably not be happy with me for saying this, but my boyfriend became responsible for caring for my cats at times when I would be traveling for days on end for the campaign. And so, much different than children, but you learn to have people who are supportive of your choices, whether that's running for office or working in an intense legal environment, whatever that looks like. Having people around you, both personally and professionally, who support what you're doing and the choices you're making. And that's, I know that you've both said that, but I want to make sure you get that message, that if you have the opportunity and you have options and choices, you know, choose to be around people that support you. And I've been privileged to have choices and to be able to choose to be in a work environment where I am supported. And I know not everybody does. But yeah, so there's so much yet to do. I think I could just, there's so many stories of being in the legislature, running for office, and what it's like as a female candidate or a female elected official. But we need more women. We need more attorneys. And so, Jen, we need you to run for office someday. I want that to be a part of what we think about as legal professionals, is how we recruit more women to take on these roles.
Right. That's exactly where I was hoping we would go, which is, why does it matter? We know that the disparity is still pretty great, and why does it matter? So efforts to quantify why increasing gender diversity on the bench and throughout other leadership positions matters have suggested it does so for a number of reasons. Interestingly, in one book, Professor Sally Kenny makes arguments focusing on the bench, but I think that they would apply to other types of our profession as well. She states that advocates for gender diversity should not argue from difference. Women should be represented on the bench, not because they reach different results, but because when women are excluded, the process and result lack legitimacy. Justice must not only be done, it must be seen to be done. Another argument she makes is that the burden of proof, in effect, should be reversed. Instead of asking what is the distinctive, unique, or different thing about women that renders their presence necessary on the bench or in leadership positions, one should ask what justifies their exclusion. So how do you see gender equity as being important to the functioning and legitimacy of our legal system? To include not just the bench, but the boardroom, corporate teams, legislative bodies, political party leadership, and to the extent you feel like you might have addressed this already, moving on to a subpart, what steps need to be taken to assess gender equity, or rather the lack thereof, and move forward within the legal profession?
So I can maybe start with this one. I was on a flight not long ago and watched the movie In Search of Greatness. It's about athletes, which I'm going to compare all of you to. And specifically Wayne Gretzky and Jerry Rice, neither of those two on paper look like they should have been these incredible athletes. They didn't have the size. They didn't have the speed. They didn't have the data to back up their successful careers. And so when they interviewed both of them, they talked a lot about what it took to find success. And it was a bit of what I talked about earlier, being disruptors of their field. So Wayne Gretzky, for example, started to do things differently. He didn't do them like everybody else did. He had to find ways to be a better hockey player than others without the speed and the size. I think of women in that same way. When you think about the benefits of having women at the table, specifically at a time when they maybe haven't been there in the past, they're disrupting what we've always known to be in a positive way. So as we move forward, I think of change as mostly positive. You head in a direction of continuing improvement and with a different voice at the table, you have a greater chance of improving, whether it's our society, whether it's policy, no matter what it is, you're going to impact change in a different kind of way. And not to say that men are always going to think about things the same way. I don't mean that. But I think it does add a very different dynamic to how we move forward in any of those industries.
I think gender equity in the context of diversity, period, makes a difference. When you have litigants that appear in front, they see somebody that doesn't look like a traditional judge that we think about. I mean, you think about judge, you automatically think white hair, white male, like all the pictures, by the way, in the federal courthouse in Fargo. That's what you think about. And so when litigants first come in, not recognizing that Sean can actually be a name for a woman, they are surprised to see something different. I don't know that I think that the outcome of proceedings is different, but we all come from a different perspective. So diversity in religion, in gender, in race, in culture makes a difference to our world. And so as North Dakota is becoming more diverse, I think it's important that we think very carefully as legislators, as lawyers, as people who work with the judiciary about what that means for an individual's day, a different perspective about how you look at things when somebody else offers you a choice. So maybe something as small as the fact that I would never schedule court on the first week of school. Never occurred to anybody before that. But I would never schedule court on 4th of July week, or I avoid it like crazy in December because I recognize that people have balancing issues, and this applies not only to women, it applies to men as well. So that tiny little perspective, but then you broaden it to other types of experiences. You know, do I automatically think that a man testifying about valuation issues in bankruptcy is more credible than a woman? No, because I've had to decide about, you know, whether the yield is affected by a certain type of chemical or whether the trade war with China will affect the price of soybeans. I get that. So do other women witnesses. So it's my expectation that I will see more bankers come to bankruptcy court and testify about persuasive, cost of inputs in farm economy. That those expectations were never there. Does it matter that I'm a woman? I don't know for sure. It matters that there's diversity of choice and that people's expectations are that there will be fairness no matter what that looks like. And I don't think you achieve true fairness unless there's some sort of diversity in the jury, in the boardroom, in and acceptance of certain policies because people come from different perspectives and backgrounds and races.
I don't know if I have much to add to this, just the general sense, belief that I have is that, you know, the Paul Wellstone quote, we all do better when we all do better, and that communities are stronger and families are stronger when everybody has access to opportunity, to education, to healthcare, and that often that a big part of that is making sure that women are at the table having those opportunities as well. And that's what Judge Hastings was saying, making sure that there's representation in our systems, meaning if you have a defendant of color, that someday there will be a judge of color that they get to appear in front of, or that their attorney looks like them, that they see that representation in real life and in media. And definitely the same for women. Again, especially in elected office, you know, right now there are still very few women in elected office in North Dakota. And I think it's important that young girls and young boys see that women can do that too. you know, I think about running last year, I ran for state tax commissioner, and I'd often get asked, well, what qualifications do you have for this office? You know, besides for being a former legislator and an attorney, I would talk about what my vision was for the office. And I knew that my male opponent never got posed the question of, well, why are you qualified to do this work? And it was in same for many things that I've been involved in. We get questioned in a different way. And that's going to be the norm until there are more women at the table all the time, every day. We have to disrupt and break that norm and make sure that it's just accepted and expected that women are in these positions and at these tables in these conversations.
So moving in a slightly different direction suggested by questions that were sent to me, the national discourse has inspired critics from outside and advocates from within the legal profession to reconsider the conventional wisdom of how the legal world approaches sexual harassment and gender bias, with obviously the Me Too movement making a lot of headlines for the past couple of years now. If we look at our rules that govern professional conduct, lawyers have a special responsibility for the quality of justice and related ethical obligations, such as to address the impediments within our profession that may perpetuate an unsafe or unwelcoming workplace for women, as well as the potential role played by the legal profession overall in things like failing to deter serial harassers or enabling the subordination of women in their workplaces. And Model Rule 8.4 is an example of these standards. So what steps do you think need to be taken to address any aspects of our profession that may perpetuate a work environment that may be unsafe and or unwelcoming for women? Or how can the profession better contribute to deterring harassment and preventing the subordination of women within the legal profession?
We have to elect more women and hire more women and have more women at the table, which is easier said than done. But I've never, in my current legal work, I've never felt unsafe or unwelcome, and I'm grateful for that. In the legislature, sometimes felt unwelcome, and certainly, you know, one of the things I'd had a conversation with the woman who held my seat before I was elected, and she was Stacey Dahl, who's also an attorney in Grand Forks, you know, was elected about the same age that I was. She also went through the legislature while in law school, so we had similar experiences. And she told me coming into the legislature that every woman, especially those of childbearing ages, will have some rumor started about them while they're in the Capitol, and that you should, you know, be prepared for that and know that that's something that's going to happen. And it did happen, and it happened to a lot of us, and there were ugly rumors. And so that was, and I wouldn't say I felt unsafe because of that, but I definitely felt super uncomfortable then around colleagues, and felt that you know, that was one way that people were undercutting the work that you were doing, because I was, you know, I was there to do a job and not to have to deal with stuff like that. And so I think for me, though, it was, you know, knowing that there were other women around. We in the legislature, both Republican and Democratic women bond together in a certain way and know that we've got to stick up for each other. And that's really important. But there's definitely some norms in elected office still that don't bode well to women wanting to come back. Say it that way.
So my experiences, again, are a little bit different just because I work within a health system. But as a large employer, I think it's important not only to have the policies, anti-harassment, anti-sexual harassment, no matter what type of harassment, the policies within whatever system or whatever organization you're working in, but they can't just be policies on a piece of paper. They have to be living and breathing, and people need to understand what those mean to the organization and to its employees. And I would say, as an employee of an organization, if you see or experience something, it's incredibly important to speak up. I think the Me Too movement has given both men and women an opportunity to do that in a way that others maybe weren't either willing to do, fearful of doing, or employers, others didn't feel the same sense of pressure. I really do believe that the Me Too movement has had an impact on our society. And then as a leader in those organizations, take action. We as a system have had to take action within my career with those that might be harassing other employees. And it sends a very strong message to any other harassers who might be considering this kind of behavior.
I think that challenge has been there for a long time, and finding appropriate solutions is difficult. I think your role as a bystander, whether you're a man or a woman, is incredibly important now, that men have a responsibility, like we have a responsibility, to speak up on behalf of the person who is being poked fun at. We have a responsibility to ensure that there is equal treatment and equal pay. I have a very close friend who is a high-level executive within an organization who has known for years that women are paid less than men for the exact same work and the exact same qualifications or comparable qualifications because they negotiate incoming salaries or are better at it, or their negotiations or were more well accepted, and is still working nonstop aggressively to try and equalize that opportunity. And as she continues to pester, and I know that that's the way it's perceived, people now look at her to join gender equity panels, to join task force and committees, because they know that, you know, she will step up, that she will tell it like it is. And as you all transition, it'll be your responsibility, both men and women, to make sure that people are treated fairly, period, and that people are paid equally, period, for the same qualifications and the same work, and then to repair what wasn't correct at one time, which is really difficult for this particular institution because, like many institutions, they're short on cash. So to make up that equity is extremely challenging. But it doesn't happen unless the bystanders are willing to stick your neck out. So if you see a young woman, you know, get in the eye or some comment, it's important that you speak up, you know, that you call people out for it and hope that they will return the favor to you. And it's critical that men do the same. It won't change without some sort of consensus.
I would add to Judge Hastings' point that, you know, we oftentimes think about harassment as the more obvious things. There are several things that happen, whether you're a man or a woman, depending upon your age, your gender, your race, that are impacting people, but not on a real obvious level. So I think it's important to be aware, and not that you want to be paranoid or thinking only about this, but I think it's really important to understand that not even the obvious harassment is usually where it starts or usually what's making the impact.
Would also add that I think as those in the legal profession, we also have an obligation to be advocates at a macro level, whether that means running for office or not. To me, it's also emailing and contacting your legislators when you see a bill in front of the legislature that would advance the cause of justice, that would better serve people in our state, in your community, that, you know, looks out for your clients, whatever, whoever they are. One example that still comes to mind for me in North Dakota is, you know, we still don't have protections for sexual orientation and gender identity in housing, employment, or public accommodation. It's still perfectly legal to discriminate against someone because of their sexual orientation in housing and employment. And rarely do we have attorneys as individuals come to the legislature and say, know this and advocate for a certain bill or a certain cause. And I think that that's important to remember, that as attorneys or future attorneys, part of your role is to be an advocate and to seek justice And that will certainly look like different things for different people. But I hope that you think about what it means at a policy level, whether that's local or state or even national, and think about your role in that work, even if you are working full-time as an attorney in private practice or elsewhere, that's something you can still do just by being attentive to the legislative process.
Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg made headlines when she said that she would be satisfied with the number of women on the Supreme Court when there are nine. Why do you think that answer attracted such attention, since in fact there were nine men on the court for nearly all of its history? And do you have thoughts about what your answer would be to that same question?
So oftentimes, when you think about change and disruption, as we were talking a little bit about earlier, the idea that generates laughter it generates laughter because it's not the norm or it's not what people think it should be. But if you take it a step further and ask why, and you take it a step further and better understand what's behind that, it's usually the idea that is the change. So in a completely different example, Uber, Lyft, people thought that was bizarre. People laughed at that idea, and all of a sudden it's taken over the transportation world. I see this very similarly in that it seems like a funny idea because it's not what we know, but it certainly would make an impact on the world.
It would be awesome whether we wouldn't notice either, right? Wouldn't that be the ultimate outcome, is that it wouldn't be about having to advocate for more men on the court or for more women on the court, but rather to just assume there would be diversity. So I laughed at it though, so that's sad.
I think that what Judge Hastings said, that it's the assumption that there will be diversity and that you don't have to be intentionally seeking women or people of color or people of different orientations or religions, that it's just a part of the pool of people, but that isn't our reality right now. And so how do we seek out diversity and how do we promote and encourage diversity in the settings that we live and work in? I don't know what my answer would be to the perfect number of women on the court or when I'd be happy with it. Certainly seeing nine would be great, but I would be happy with five. That would be a good place to start.
How about we start with North Dakota and get one?
Yes. So we have one question, and it is as follows. Can we please open it up to questions from the audience for the last 5 minutes? So, yes, I'd love to hear a question or two from the audience. We don't have any mics set up, so you'll have to project.
How do we get women to apply and put themselves out there to take the risk for those positions that we haven't been in before?
So I can start. I will spend whatever amount of time that any one of you wants to come and spend with me to talk about what your career aspirations are and how I can support you, whether that's in the type of law that I practice or otherwise. I think it starts there. I think female students at this point in their career and probably much earlier in age need mentors and need to feel supported. So Professor Jackson was that to me. She gave me a lot of confidence in what I was capable of doing and helped support me in what I would feel, what I would say felt like a safe way. And I think that it's incredibly important that both men and women offer to be mentors and offer to support women in any aspirations that they may have going forward.
I call people, and I think Justice Fair McIvers knows that. I think it's important that you take opportunities like the ones that the law school is setting up now for women who have an opportunity to get together to just network. I think you take those opportunities, you meet those people, and when you do, you encourage them. I am so delighted that you ran for office. And I think it's the diversity is extremely important. I wish we had more women on both sides of the aisle, and I will tell you that I will encourage them to do that. And you vote. When you vote, it matters who you vote for, because they will lead us through and to policies of gender equality and also diversity. So your vote really matters. And I sit here today hoping that you will run, hoping that you will apply, hoping that you will put yourself out there in times when it's extremely awkward. And it's not an easy thing. Trust me, I get it. Do it. I really hope you do.
That intentional encouragement and seeking out others. You know, after my first session in the legislature, I formed the Democratic Women's Caucus with the purpose of recruiting and supporting female candidates. You know, we raised money for them, we held events, we tried to seek out those candidates and find new ways to support them and to provide that mentorship. You know, we had this network of existing or past female legislators, and we'd say, you know, Joan's an expert on education and agriculture and ABC. So if you have questions about this issue, reach out to this person. And just, you know, having that built-in network of support was really helpful. You know, I wouldn't have run for office if someone hadn't asked me. I wouldn't have run for party chair if that same person hadn't asked me to do that and encouraged me. And that's the truth. I think research shows that women especially need to be asked 7 times before they will seriously think about running for office. And that women often think that they aren't qualified, that they don't have the right skills or experience to run for office. And I can tell you that is just blatantly untrue. So I do hope that you'll think about running for office, but if you think that that's, you know, not in your wheelhouse, not in your plans, think about somebody else that should. Or if you're looking at applying for a job, or you know there's a job opening, encourage a female colleague to step up and apply for that job. I think Justice McEvers was getting at open judgeships in particular, and you know we should be thinking about all of the great women lawyers that we know and encouraging them to apply for open judgeships, both at the state and federal level, because there are several, and there's been a lot of openings over the past few years. And so it's important that we have women applying for those positions and seeking out those opportunities. But often it takes somebody encouraging them or asking them to do that. So if you're not going to be the one to run, be the one to ask someone else to step up and do it. I will briefly share a story that's a literal, you know, sense of me walking into a room that I wasn't invited to. My first session as a legislator, I served on the Human Services Committee. There were 10 men of one party and 3 women of a different party. And as I was sitting on the floor, I had a question about something in my committee and realized that all of the men from my committee were gone, and nobody was on the floor, nobody was around. And so I thought, well, shoot, I missed a meeting, I missed an email. So I ran down to our committee room and nobody was there. And so I came back up and I still couldn't find, like, noticeably all of these 10 men were missing from the floor of the House. And so I asked someone, well, if you were a member of this committee, where would you be right now? And he said, well, I saw your chairman go upstairs, and there's a conference room right above our House chambers. And I went up there. You can't see inside the door. It's not like a glass window pane or anything. But I opened the door, and sure enough, all 10 of the men from my committee were sitting there with their committee binders and having conversations about our committee work, which is illegal in North Dakota under open meetings and open records laws. and so I just walked in and sat down at the table, and I could see everybody. their eyes got big, and they got noticeably uncomfortable that they were found. And nobody knew what to say, and they all kind of shuffled papers around to try to talk about something else. And finally, one of the men across the table said, "Welcome to the Republican Party." And I didn't laugh, because I don't think he realized that what they were doing was wrong. But when we got back to our actual committee room, when we were, you know, on public record again, I called my chairman out for this happening, and just said, you know, if you're going to be having these discussions about issues that we've all got to vote on, make sure that everybody's at the table to be a part of the discussion. And I just left it at that. And he just said, duly noted, and moved on. But for me, the courage and the mindset I had in that, my frustration wasn't really that I wasn't at the table, but that the district and the people that I represent weren't at the table when this committee was making decisions. And that it was important, as attorneys, as legislators, as advocates, that you're often, the decisions you make, the actions you take aren't often just on your own behalf. You are setting a standard. You are speaking up on behalf of others. And that's especially true, of course, for attorneys. But whether or not it's, an instance of harassment or something that you're speaking out about personally, know that when you do that, you're making a difference for everybody that comes after you or around you, and that the role you play in that is much bigger than yourself. And so that's, that's a good question, because it's something that can be exceptionally hard to find when you're in really difficult circumstances like we might often find ourselves. But I think for me, it's recognizing that my impact and my work is larger than,
on a far less nobler note, I will follow up with a really short story. When I was working for the Air Force back in the 80s, this is 87, 88, I was an intern. And I was working on this big project for pricing for one of the contracts for the Air Force. And I was in an internship position, and there was another male intern who started at the same time, and then a younger associate who was a full-time employee, but still within a couple of years of us in terms of age. And I finished this big project that I'd spent a lot of time on, and the two of them took it and went to another room and discussed it. So I went to the bathroom and cried. And then got up the nerve to walk back in and said, "You just took my work and you didn't include me in this conversation." And so they were embarrassed and they included me, and I was never excluded again. So my advice and answer to the question is, believe in yourself. There is a, Sheryl Sandberg in her book talks about the fact that women will apply for a job when they're 95% qualified and men 50%. Think like a man. Apply.
Yeah, my advice is very similar. Just to be brave, because if you are qualified, if you have the skills, you know it, you will teach them that you have those skills and that you're qualified as well. That being said, it's important, no matter who you are, what your gender is, that you are skilled. So it can't be an expectation that you should just assume you have this job or that you're being treated unfairly. Everyone deserves the opportunity, but be willing to work hard, educate yourself. And I think one of the questions that, and one of the talking points, just to give us a sense of what we might talk about today, was, do you think that women are held to a higher standard? I'm okay with being held to a really high standard because I want to hold myself to that standard. So be brave and go in educated and willing to do the work.
I'm sorry to hear that it's happening in the classrooms. I think that hopefully professors see this when it's happening and are able to be an ally in calling that out. But call it out and support each other in doing so. It's a lonely feeling sometimes to be the one who's speaking up and speaking out. So that's, supporting each other and being willing to do that together is important. Speak out for someone else when you see it happening. But I think, and Professor Cook was talking about this, the one-on-one conversations, bringing it home and having conversations with your family, with your friends, with your workplace, in a comfortable, non-adversarial setting is the, in my perspective, the best way to start bringing people back together. My much like your family, my family is very conservative. My dad has worked in the oil industry his whole life, my whole life. And so we don't always see eye to eye on things. But we've, throughout my involvement in politics, he's been very supportive. He only jokes every time I come home about my being a Democrat. But he has said, Kylie, through your experience doing all of this and watching you go through this, my heart has changed. I'm able to see things differently. And so that, again, the personal conversation, bringing people together, I think is really important. That's hard to do, and that's not going to change the country overnight, but I think it's a small thing we can all do to hopefully make big change.
Yeah, to that point, the question more specifically to the classroom is a difficult one, because as Kylie mentioned, you cannot make that change overnight. You can, though, choose the relationships you have with people, choose your partner, who can be supportive not only of you, but of women in general. You, as you become a parent, you can raise both boys and girls, to be very supportive of women, because I think it's equally as important to do that with boys as it is with girls. And you start to make an impact at a much earlier age that then can carry with them over a long period of time.
Your relationships here at the law school really matter. And so lifting people up and calling people out in a professional way, like a lawyer would, to say, hey, that's not acceptable. It's just not. So everyone has to assume responsibility for that. And as you build relationships here and you help somebody out with the rule against perpetuities and they return the favor with some other arcane constitutional law principle, keep in mind that there's lots of different ways to help people, and your professionalism and your integrity will make a difference in the long run. I can tell you that, you know, now my colleagues are, you know, applying for judicial positions or are in senior level management positions or have made choices to, you know, work as newspaper reporters and have influence in lots of different ways. And they will reach back to you and to the people who have the integrity. And so set the example. And then don't be shy of having, you know, conversations with people. And maybe it means a one-on-one. You know, or maybe it means in the moment that you just say, not acceptable. It's hard to do that, and you have to be brave.
Yeah. Your fantastic insight. We appreciate you taking your time. So we do have lunch just across the hall. We'll be back here at 1 o'clock for our final panel. So thank you. Enjoy lunch.